This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled The Evolution of the World and of Humanity. This is Lecture 12. Let us begin today by calling to mind the various considerations that have been here set forth concerning the world of man. Remembering that man bears the world's past history within him, if only in the form of pictures, and that he can arouse within him in consecutive series, as it were, these pictures of the past ages of the world. Nothing of all this enters man's ordinary day consciousness except memory, which reminds him of the experiences he has had in his earth life. But when he directs this ordinary consciousness along the paths I have described, by the agency of the spiritual consciousness, which becomes clearer and clearer, the past ages of the evolution of the world rise one by one within him. And as we have seen, he must again experience this cosmic past between death and a new birth. We may say that when that which is imperceptible to the senses becomes gradually visible in imagination, even in earth existence, man looks back not only at the pictures of his present earth life, preserved in his memory, but at that which gave him form, and which, as the forces of growth and of nourishment, which indeed proceed from the spirit, fashioned him from within. At a further stage, by means of inspiration, man looks into pre-earthly existence, though not into that of his own being. We have seen how he sets sail, as it were, from the cosmic earth island into the free cosmic world ocean, in which are embedded the stars, though he now perceives these as the dwelling places of spiritual beings. Then, when intuition appears, man looks back into his own past earth lives, and at the same time beholds the whole collective life of the world in ages past. Man is indeed born from the whole universe, and it lives in his physical, etheric, and astral body, and at any rate, during his earth existence, in his ego. All this is in man. It works and lives in his inner being. Thus we as human beings bear within us the whole past evolution of the world, at which countless generations of divine spiritual beings have worked. In the structure of our organs, in the forces which permeate and pulsate within them, lies the whole work of generations of divine spirits. We bear these within us when the forces of our organs blossom forth into our thoughts and feelings. We carry within us the result of the whole evolution of the world, in so far as it belongs to the past. Now, after we have sharpened our vision for the past, at any rate as far as our thoughts are concerned, and look with our ordinary consciousness at the world that forms our environment here on earth, we see nothing of that world but what our senses record and our reason, based upon the observations of senses, can digest, which, however, is but the smallest part. Behind sense existence is the wide expanse of spiritual existence, that existence which is active in all the colors to be seen and in all the sounds to be heard in nature, in all that we know as cold and warmth, in everything which impresses man in the phenomena of nature. Behind the manifested physical natural existence, there is a concealed spiritual natural existence, a concealed spiritual world around us. This spiritual environment, of which we, with our sense perception, see merely the surface, is even now in the womb of man's future evolution. Just as we now carry in mighty pictures the whole past in our inner being, and indeed are ourselves the result of those pictures, so in this concealed nature is working and weaving that which, when it develops further as world evolution, will bring us our future. We may therefore inscribe in our minds the following momentous saying, quote, "Man in his inner being carries the past ages of the world. The world in its outer being carries the future of man." Close quote. These two sentences express the evolution of the world and of man. They are expressed even in the individual life of man. There is a mighty difference between all that belongs to the organization of man's head and the rest of his physical body. The forces at work there are, of course, roughly speaking, of a finer quality. We may say that the forces working from the heart toward the head give the latter its peculiar configuration, causing it to be surrounded by the hard skull covering and to be filled with that which represents the most wonderful structure in the whole world, namely the convolutions and interlacings of the human brain and the location therein of the human senses. Everything that lives in these forces and radiates from chest and heart toward the head of man is the result of the past. It could only become what it now is in man because, as I have said, countless generations of spiritual beings worked as they did through all the metamorphoses of the cosmic bodies throughout the planetary transformations. In esoteric science, I drew attention to the fact that this Earth evolution was preceded by a Saturn evolution, a Sun evolution, and a Moon evolution, after which followed the evolution in which we are now living, that of the Earth, which began with the recapitulation of the three former evolutions. In the development of mankind on Earth, we are now a little beyond the middle of the Earth evolution proper. All the forces which have gradually developed in the course of long periods of time, under the influence of divine generations, live in the physical body of man himself. They radiate upward from the heart toward the head. In all that we continually bear within us in our physical, etheric, astral, and ego being, radiating from the middle man to the head man, generations of divine beings have for countless ages worked, preparing, and making ready. The last of that which lives in these radiating forces, and of which the man of today is still unconscious, expresses itself as his karma, the past of his own ego during his earth life. One may therefore say that when we penetrate to these cosmic memory forces, we first of all perceive our karma, then the different stages of the earth's evolution, and then finally we see the metamorphoses, the planetary transformations of the earth before it became earth proper. For before the earth could come into being, a cosmic body had to arise, consisting of nothing but fine heat, Saturn. That had to die and arise again to a new existence as sun, of which we see the last remnants outside in cosmic space as our present sun. The old sun was a cosmic body consisting solely of air, and that too had to die in order that a cosmic body consisting of a more watery substance, the moon, might arise. That also had to die, that the more solid earth might appear, consisting of a mineral substance on which man could then develop and become the earth man he now is. But just as we possess the upward striving forces, so too do we bear within us the forces that strive downward and have a sort of center in the heart, and the effect of these two opposing forces is that the blood is caused to circulate and to flow into the movements of our limbs. What is contained in these forces lives in every movement of our hands when we lay hold of anything or carry out any external earth activity. It lives in every step we take to accomplish our earth deeds. These forces belong to the concealed environment. They do not belong to the past, but to the concealed world that surrounds us. They will only be taken into the bosom of the past, a past belonging to the future, when man goes through the gates of death and exchanges his earth existence for that of the stars. In these forces, the future of man is being prepared. This future will come about through the reciprocal action of these forces and those concealed in nature. Thus the world carries within it the future of man in its own evolution. Now these upper and lower forces are very dissimilar in man. The knowledge that can be attained on passing the guardian of the threshold shows how great the difference is between these two forces going in different directions. As far as man's ordinary consciousness is concerned, he is conscious of nothing below his heart. But although he has no consciousness of the fact, this lower part is, nonetheless, filled with a consciousness, only man cannot as yet penetrate it. Man, as regards his experience, is differently constituted inwardly from what he is as regards his consciousness. In his normal consciousness, he is only aware of that part of his experience which rises like an island to the surface. But this is no longer the case when one can see man as he is, realizing that he is even now equipped with these subhuman forces, as we might call them. One can then see how a man may accomplish a particular deed, which at that particular moment of his life on earth gives him pleasure and satisfaction. His head is satisfied. Perhaps for some reason or other he may commit a very wicked act. His head may be satisfied, for the circumstances connected with this action are concealed from his ordinary consciousness. But a man's head may be filled with great satisfaction, while the hand that commits the act trembles in his subconsciousness, which becomes conscious in the cosmos. Although the trembling may not be outwardly perceptible, yet in his etheric and astral bodies there is, as it were, a sort of earthquake. A man may feel in his head a complete satisfaction at the accomplishment of a certain action, while in his subconsciousness this satisfaction becomes a trembling in the astral etheric organs connected with the arms or those connected with the legs. The consciousness expires, as we might say, in that which produces satisfaction in the head as the accomplishment of an evil deed. And another consciousness awakens in that which in the lower man trembles at the act. In this trembling, his coming karma is prepared. For it is the trembling of the forces of the concealed nature of the hidden world. In this trembling, man feels in advance what he will experience as the judgment of the stars when he leaves the earth island for the wide ocean of stellar existence. Thus we may say, within man, even in the outer form of his physical body, live in different ways both the past and the future of the world. That which man bears within him as the organization of his head, and which is the most marvelous and perfect production of the world development, falls to pieces for the most part, even as regards its inner spiritual content, when man passes through the gates of death. On the other hand, that which man has in the lower part of his organization, even if merely observed physically, presents an image in the physical of what lives as spiritual soul nature in his arms, hands, and the whole organization of his limbs and metabolic system. For in these there live not only what can be seen as flesh and blood, but forces also. Behind much of what you see as the flesh and blood forming the physical nature of arms and hands, live the spiritual forces. These forces at the present time flow through our arms and legs. In a future earth life, they will flow through that which gives the jaws an upward and downward movement, in the extension of the upper and lower jaws toward the back. The bones of the head will, in the next earth life, in their plastic formation, be the transformed bones of the arms and legs. Of course, I mean the spiritual part of these, for the physical falls away. What are now attached to us as our arms and legs will, in our next earthly incarnation, be attached to us as the configuration of our head, as far as its forces and dynamics are concerned. Thus even man's physical organism presents an image which shows how he has gone through his earth life, the forms he created through what he accomplished in ordinary life by his actions and behavior to man and to the earth world by means of his arms and hands in the preceding earth life. The actions of his hands and arms in the one earth incarnation live on in the formation of the head in the succeeding one. Ordinary phrenology is but dilettante in this respect, for it gives all sorts of intellectual interpretations about the formation of the head. Behind this, however, there is a profound occult phrenology, which is individual in each man, and cannot therefore be learned by universal rules, but can, by means of intuition, unravel from the shape of a man's head what he prepared for himself by the movements in walking, by the action of his hands, and the deeds of his preceding earth life. Thus past and future hang together in the evolution of world and man. In the present earth existence, man stands before us, and himself, as a manifestation of the work of generations of divine beings who have worked for countless ages to make him what he has now become. Of course, it is only possible to outline in a sketchy fashion how the pictures presented by modern humanity indicate what these generations of spirits, through all the metamorphoses of the Earth evolution and that of Saturn, Sun, and Moon, have accomplished for the whole life of man. Let us just consider three significant impulses in the Earth life of man, which we must regard as being specially distinctive to mankind. If we contemplate, even with ordinary consciousness, the marvel that reveals itself in the gradual development of a human being from the first days of his life, we can, if we have the vision for this, get at any rate some idea of the profound depths from which the soul and spirit nature works its way up in order to mold the somewhat undefined form of a child in the first days and weeks of its life into a more definite form, and later to transform the chaotic movements of the arms and legs into regular movements. We can then dimly surmise that something is thereby revealed, which lives as a spiritual element in the depths of the concealed life of nature, and finds expression in the body. It may be said that nothing more marvelous can be seen on the earth than this wondrous unfolding of the inner into the outer man in the young child during the very first years of its development. We may say that if we are able to permeate this perception with a truly artistic religious feeling, it transcends all that can merely be observed. It transcends even the humility which may take hold of us before the spiritual element thus revealed. It transcends all the artistic, scientific, or religious impressions we can obtain from the external world. There are three things that specially strike us in this development and unfoldment of the young child. In ordinary life, we say, a child learns to walk. That indeed is a wonderful thing. These words convey a great sense of movement. Child uses all its limbs to raise itself from a position in which the spine is parallel with the earth's surface to an upright position. The simple words, the child learns to walk, in which we express this most obvious and self-evident occurrence, also imply that, when this takes place, the child learns to direct all its forces in a different direction on earth. It learns to take its place in the cosmos through its own inner balance and the symmetry of its forces. Now we can also see in this an image showing how man has outgrown the animal world. For the animal cannot do this. It does not experience this moment in its life. The animal remains essentially with its spine parallel with the earth. For even when, as in the case of the ape, it stands upright, this upward direction is in contradiction to its organization. If a man wants to judge, he must be able to look in the right light at the circumstances of the child learning to walk. The natural scientists have compared the human bones with those of animals, and have found that the former are transformed animal bones, and that human muscles are a conversion of animal muscles, and so on with all the organs. Not in this way, however, can the difference between man and the animals be ascertained. This can only be discovered by studying the moment when the child, early in its life, raises itself from what makes it like the animal and balances itself in harmony with the equilibrium of the whole world. The human being could never have acquired this art in life had it not been prepared in far distant ages. This art already reposed germinally in man during the Saturn existence. During that epoch, divine spirits laid the germ of what the child manifests when, as we say, it learns to walk. There were no animals present then. They only came later, during the sun existence, so that as regards his foundations, man is older than the animal. All that lies in that invisible force nature which enables man to walk is in its origin to be traced back to the Saturn existence. The second thing that appears in the child is that, as a result of its orientation in space, the forces press inward and reappear in a different fashion. I grasp the child. In so doing, a force works in an outward direction. At the same time, a counteracting force works inward and discharges itself in the inner organs. This sense of direction and movement, this force directed inward, enters the limbs and shows itself in the development of the child when it learns to speak. The second quality acquired by the child is learning to speak. The forces first press outward and the child learns to direct itself in space. The same forces then turn inward and the child learns to speak. Natural science only indicates a small part of this. It only points out that persons who are right-handed have the seat of speech in the left half of the brain, while in left-handed persons the seat of speech is in the right half of the brain. But everything in the brain which is connected with the development of speech is first worked into the brain by the limbs when the child learns to walk, to grasp, to move about, to take hold of things. These are the inward-going forces, which then pass from the brain into the organs of speech. Again, for countless ages, the divine spiritual beings have worked at the human organism to make the child ready for speech. The reason that the human being is able to learn to speak comes from the fact that the divine spiritual beings who prepared his power of walking in the Saturn epoch worked on further in the Sun epoch to enable him to produce speech. The third thing the child develops out of speech, and which humanity itself has also developed from speech, for only in the earth evolution did men learn to speak and to think, is the power of thinking. Thought has been prepared in advance by the divine spiritual beings ever since the moon age. Such is the evolution of man in the past ages of the world, during which divine spiritual generations have worked in him, walking, speaking, and thinking in the Saturn, Sun, and Moon evolutions. During the Sun evolution, the animal world was added to the world evolution, though of course in a different form from today. Today the animals must eat plants. They had no need for that then. They were beings living only in the air and consisting of air substance. During the moon existence, the plants were added. Evolution then passed over to the earth existence. Only then did man develop that wherein the forces of walking, speaking, and thinking could live in visible form, the human form and figure. The mineral kingdom was then added to man. Such are the characteristics of the past development of mankind. If we wish to look at the future development of man, we must consider old age. If we must have something belonging to the present time by which to characterize it, we must take that which in present humanity is considered extremely unimportant, the fact of growing old. While that which is revealed in the development of the child, in its walking, speaking, and thinking, is open to observation and manifests outwardly, that which becomes more and more spiritual as man grows older is but little noticed today, unless one observes with spiritual vision. It is wonderful to see how the soul and spirit nature is more and more revealed in the body in old age. And if this is rightly perceived, it gives one a deep religious feeling. We are overcome by its wondrous art. On the other hand, it is just as worthy of admiration to see how what man experiences in his whole being by walking, speaking, and thinking all through his earth life gradually disappears again into the spiritual in preparation for the passage through the gates of death. How the thoughts, words, and all that man has achieved and worked at with his hands vanishes into the spiritual. But this spiritual part which he acquires through his thinking, speaking, and walking, he carries back with him through the gates of death into the spiritual life. Just as what appears in the child as walking, speaking, and thinking points us to the foregoing stages of the earth's evolution, so does what man experiences in his thoughts point him to his next earth life, and thence into the great epoch of the earth's evolution. Thus evolution and the development of the world and of man point to that condition which can only be experienced when the earth has once more died and re-arisen in a new planetary existence, the Jupiter existence. And to that the thoughts of men direct us. These human thoughts themselves will not then live as fluctuating thoughts in man, but will have form. The formed thoughts will then appear in the form of man. At the present time, we are able to conceal our thoughts within us, and our countenance may in certain circumstances have a very innocent appearance, whereas we may be inwardly guilty. In the next metamorphosis of the earth, the Jupiter existence, that will no longer be possible. Our countenance will bear the outward expression created by our thought. For our human form will not be so solid or so mineral. It will itself be inwardly mobile and consist of very soft and pliable substance. Whenever a wrong thought arises in a man, it will be seen by his fellow beings in the instantaneous form of his face. Every thought will instantly take form, and all permanent thoughts, everything of the nature of temperament, will walk about as men. In the Jupiter existence, if a man is a scoundrel or has animal desires, it will be immediately apparent. That is the first stage of the future of humanity. The second stage is that in which man will develop something out of his speech. Speech today can only penetrate outwardly from within, through the medium of air. In the future, speech will become creative. The spoken word will not only sound in the air, but will be permanent. Man will create form through the word. Thus, even in the Jupiter age, man will, by his thoughts, create forms of himself, and in the Venus existence, he will create his own surroundings by the word. The situation will then be as follows. If a man utters a bad word during this Venus existence, which consists essentially of substance as fine as air, something like a hideous plant form will immediately come into existence. A man will thus have his own words around him. What lives in the action of walking, in the movement of the arms, will develop in the final metamorphosis of the earth, in the Vulcan existence. Creative speech and the feelings which are of a speech-creative nature will appear during the Venus existence. Today we accomplish our deeds and carry out our actions with our arms, but these are not permanent. We go forth to accomplish something, some very complicated business perhaps, or war may even be carried on. But we go on our way. Nothing of all this remains in the external world. During the Vulcan existence, everything will be permanent. Man will then not only walk about and touch things, but the fact of his walking and touching is inscribed into the Vulcan existence. His actions materialize. In the Vulcan existence, therefore, we have the materialized actions of man. You see what a mighty incision is made by the earth existence between the past and the future of the evolution of the world and of man. Everything that was brought about on earth till then was accomplished by generations of divine spiritual beings. What is to come will be accomplished by man himself. That is what the entrance of free will into the human being signifies in the cosmos. Man is placed in this world by gods. By them he is given his free existence, his walking, speaking, and thinking, and indeed even his form. By means of his walking, speaking, and thinking, he will in the future insert into the evolution of the world that which he himself is. Man is now engaged in making his way from the past into the future. He has part of the past in what lies in his own karma, and part of the future in the karma he makes for his own future. Man is now in a sense going through his school time between the past and the future. This, however, prevents things from being precisely fulfilled in accordance with the scheme I described yesterday. I said that 2,160 years ought really to pass between every two incarnations, but man is far from absorbing all he should from earth life during his earth existence. Hence, in reality, even at the present time, the intervals between death and a new birth are of quite a different length, and indeed do not last 2,160 years for anyone, but are substantially shorter. Persons wholly given up to earth life, who have something criminal in their nature, have amassed but few possibilities of setting sail for the ocean of stellar life. They return very soon to earth life, having spent but a short time between death and their new birth. Others again must bring to greater perfection the spirit and soul nature they developed in earth life, and require longer time to refine it. We may therefore say that in particular men of animal tendencies, who are easy prey to their desires and passions, soon come back, while those who undergo a normal spiritual development return later. Others there may be who, having a deeper insight into the needs of the present age, and looking with deep and spiritual vision into the cosmos, create in themselves the impulse, even while in earth life, being ready to make the sacrifice, to return as soon as they are able to work again at the evolution of the earth. It is possible by developing love for the spirit while still in earth life to pass much more rapidly through the 3 to 6 transitions I described yesterday through the Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn beings. A man who passes through the gates of death, equipped with lower impulses, shrinks back in fear from completing the cycles, and is in particular hurled back from the region of the planetoids. I shall speak tomorrow of how men are driven into various circles through having given way to certain influences in the world, either in their personal or national life, and so on. The man who ascends in the right way to the region of the planetoids spends from 700 to 800 years between one earth life and the next. That is the normal time for those persons who have not really low natures. Through a deeper insight and love for the spiritual world, the life between death and rebirth can, however, be consciously shortened. Those whose nature leads them to gain a great deal from this earth life may come back comparatively soon, that they may help as soon as possible by working to transform the civilization of the earth. I was obliged to carry you in thought out of the earthly world into the world of the stars, into the world of the inhabitants of the stars, so as to direct you in the way that is right for the present day, from that world in which man is now involved to that which he must enter through knowledge, if he is to experience his future existence aright. On the whole, man is today far from wrenching himself free from the material world and from seeking for the spiritual in a physical world immediately surrounding us. It is rather late now to point out the hindrances confronting the present-day man when he tries to penetrate, at any rate, the world of the human mind, as is done in psychoanalysis, of which I will speak further tomorrow. The right way can be found precisely from direct observation of the physical. The spiritual can be found through investigation of natural physical functions from the standpoint of modern science. A proof of this is given in the pamphlet just published by our Physiological-Biological Institute in Stuttgart. Frau Dr. Kalisko publishes the results of her splendid researches under the title Physiological and Physical Proof of the Efficacy of the Smallest Entities. That was a title. Homeopathy, as you know, tries to work by strongly refining physical matter. By so doing, by reducing physical matter into strong solution, by transcending the working power of matter, one comes to the spiritual. We have now succeeded in actually proving that it is possible to discover, by the most exact methods, the working of the tiniest entities, the greatest rarefactions. Now, Dr. Kalisko has followed out for a long time, very conscientiously, the hints I have given her in this direction, and has succeeded in producing rarefactions of 1 to 1 trillion. Just think, if we completely dissolve a substance in a glass of water and pour half of it away, pouring the remainder into a glass and filling that up with water, we obtain a dilution of 1 to 2. If we half that again and fill up the glass with fresh water, we obtain 1 to 4, and so on. Well, in our Biological Institute in Stuttgart, by means of conscientious and exact methods, it has been possible to make dilutions of 1 to 1 trillion. In this way, the so-called higher potencies are reached. In this work you find, through the experiments made with the antimony, for instance, concerning which I have spoken here in my medical lectures, that when we produce the 21st potency or thereabouts, the growth of a plant, of a grain of wheat, for instance, is slowest, whereas with a potency of about 29, 30, it is quickest. So that when the fluidity of a substance is reduced to a high potency, and as I said, it is possible to produce a potency of 1 to 1 trillion, we see that the lower potencies and greatest rarefactions, excuse me, let me see that again, it is possible to produce a potency of 1 to 1 trillion, we see that the lower potencies and greatest rarefications make the plant germ grow fastest, which means that they stimulate the life force most. Along these lines, we have succeeded in dividing what is merely material so that what is really the spiritual part becomes apparent. For if you do not simply split matter into atoms, as the atomists do, but reduce it to its functions and forces, you prove your goodwill, as I might say, to pass through the material itself into the spiritual. You can imagine what this means for the exact intuitive perception of remedies in their action on the human organism. For here the working can be seen. The dilution is produced. We have it in glass receptacles in the laboratory. We cause one grain of wheat to germinate in one potency, another in another, and so on. While this exact investigation was going on, whole rooms were filled with germs of wheat grains, in which could be seen how the different dilutions affect the earth in which the wheat germinates. This is what present-day science must become, so that this material knowledge may be driven to the spiritual. As you know, there has always been a conflict between homeopathy and allopathy as to the effect of small entities and minute dilutions. Till now, the whole thing was more or less a question of faith. One person believed in the one, another person in the other. Now there is no question here of siding with homeopathy, but of establishing exact scientific facts. Of course, in time to come, it will be known where substances must be used allopathically, so that they may work in the right way on the patient, and especially exercise an influence on the human etheric body, which represents the life forces. And it will also be known when they must be diluted. In the future, a line will be drawn. Here you use allopathy, here homeopathy. For just as other scientific experiments are made with the greatest care and exactitude, so in this pamphlet by Frau Dr. Kalisko, titled Physiological and Physical Proof of the Efficacy of the Smallest Entities, proof is offered by our biological laboratories in Stuttgart that the very smallest entities are really efficacious. What has hitherto been a subject of faith is now raised to a real domain of science. This is not all. There is another point. In this pamphlet you can see the exact curves worked out, showing how the forces of growth rise and fall. You can see how the curve must be drawn for smaller dilutions, and how for greater ones. You can see how certain dilutions produce the minimum, while greater dilutions produce the maximum of growth. The curve then drops back to the minimum to rise again to the maximum. Thus, in the extremely conscientious drawing of these curves, we obtain a direct insight into a rhythm working in all matter, a rhythm which expresses the spiritual in all matter. In man, we pass from the metabolic system to the rhythmic system, and we can also discover the rhythmic system in nature in a quite exact scientific way. This you can see in this book, which I think may really be a milestone in the medical question as to the comparative merits of homeopathy and allopathy, as well as in the insight into nature. In future, if this result of research is valued aright, investigations will not merely be made along the lines of scale and measure. The laws of nature will not merely be investigated atomically, but it will be recognized that in all matter a rhythm can be discovered, and that the rhythm in the occurrences of nature reproduce the rhythm of the cosmos. In this I only wanted to point out one way which must be followed based on exact science. Tomorrow I shall proceed to show how, for instance, in psychoanalysis and such methods, there is something like a theoretical dislike to follow the methods leading from the natural physical to the spiritual. If mankind wishes civilization to progress instead of to decline, the spiritual paths must be followed. The end of Lecture 12.